welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first LQ update I have is just a heads up, really, that we now have a new URL structure at LQ. The URLs should be much easier to remember now and should actually give you a little bit of metadata about the page that you're viewing. And they no longer have any of the numeric parameters or anything like that in them, so they're a little bit cleaner. All old URLs will redirect to the new ones in perpetuity, so none of your bookmarks or links or existing links out in the web, none of that stuff will break. They'll always redirect, and we have no plans to ever change that. The code was thoroughly tested, but if you notice any issues, please let us know. Next LQ update, really just a note to say that I had a really great time at the Ohio Linux Fest. A little bit of time has passed since I did the last podcast, so this is a little bit old, but the smaller community type events really are a great time. If there's one in your area, I highly recommend you go to it. I think the next one that I will be attending is probably Scale, which is coming up in a couple months. It's in February. I unfortunately missed the Ontario Linux Fest due to a scheduling conflict, but the community events are definitely something next year that I'm going to try and focus on and hit up as many as I possibly can. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is patent infringement lawsuit filed against Red Hat and Novell. To start this off with a little bit of a backstory, earlier this month, Ballmer reiterated his stance on patents in Linux, and this is from him. Quote, Microsoft Chief Executive Steve Ballmer has warned users of Red Hat Linux that they will have to pay Microsoft for its intellectual property. People who use Red Hat, at least with respect to our intellectual property, in a sense have an obligation to compensate us, Ballmer said last week at a company event in London discussing online services in the UK. End quote. For its part, Red Hat fired back fairly quickly with the following. Quote, Red Hat is assuring its customers that they can continue to deploy its Linux operating system with confidence and without fear of legal retribution from Microsoft, despite the increasingly vocal threats emanating from the Redmond, Washington company. In a scathing response to Ballmer's remarks, Red Hat's IP team said that the reality is that the community development approach of free and open source code represents a healthy development paradigm, which, when viewed from the perspective of pending lawsuits related to intellectual property, is at least as safe as proprietary software. We are also aware of no patent lawsuit against Linux, ever, anywhere, the team said in a blog posting. The Linux vendor, which is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, also gives customers open-source intellectual property protections through its open-source assurance program, which includes a promise to replace the software if there is any intellectual property issue. This provides customers with assurances of uninterrupted use of the technology solution. Protecting our customers is a top priority, and we take it very seriously. Our confidence in our technology and protections from customers remains strong and has not wavered, the blog posting said. End quote. Now, while many people thought that Ballmer was just continuing his FUD campaign, a scant couple days later after that initial comment, an IP infringement lawsuit was actually filed, although not by Microsoft. And this is from the announcement. Quote, Plaintiffs, IP Innovation and Technology Licensing Corp. claim to have the rights to U.S. Patent No. 5072412 for a user interface with multiple workspaces for sharing display systems. And it was issued December 10, 1991, along with two other similar patents. Defendants Red Hat Inc. and Novell have allegedly committed acts of infringement through the products including Red Hat Linux System, the Novell SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop, and the Novell SUSE Linux Enterprise Server. Red Hat and Novell's infringement, contributory infringement, and inducement to infringe have injured plaintiffs, and plaintiffs are entitled to recover damages adequate to compensate them for such infringements, but in no event less than a reasonable royalty, the original complaint states. The plaintiffs also allege that defendants received notice of the patents, therefore the infringing activities have been deliberate and willful. Plaintiffs are seeking an injunction from the court, increased damages, and other relief that the court or jury may deem just and proper. The case has been assigned to U.S. District Judge Leonard E. Davis. End quote. You have to kind of find it ironic that a company called IP Innovation is suing based on something seemingly obvious that was patented in 1991 by Xerox, so clearly they're not innovating anything. Things do get a little bit interesting from here, though. It seems that IP Innovation LLC is a subsidiary of another company, and looking at that company closer, you see that they just recently announced that two ex-Microsoft people are joining their company, and that's Jonathan Taub, who was the Director of Strategic Alliances for the Mobile and Embedded Division, and Brad Brunel, who was the former Microsoft General Manager of Intellectual Property Licensing. So the SCOEX trial isn't even officially over, and we already have a company with seemingly large Microsoft ties filing a clear patent troll case against Linux. Now, you'd think that they'd hide that connection a little bit better this time, but it should be noted that IP Innovation appears to have previously gotten some money out of Apple so it's definitely simply not aimed just at open source. How much of this we're going to see and have to go through until the system actually gets fixed remains to be seen, but I think the answer is clearly too much. Now, digging a little bit further, and on the 451 Chaos Theory blog, it looks like the lawsuit may actually have almost nothing to do with open source and just be another general patent troll case. And from that post, quote, "The nation's first Linux patent suit currently facing Red Hat and Novell isn't about open source at all. Or so the plaintiff says. IP Innovation last week filed a patent lawsuit in Texas, alleging that both Red Hat and Novell infringe on the U.S. patent. Neither IP Innovation nor its parent company responded to the request for comment at the time of the patent suit first came to light. But today, in a statement sent to InternetNews.com, the chairman and CEO Paul Ryan defended the firm's actions and argued that there is no conspiracy against open source coming from his firm. IP Innovation is not attempting to inject itself in the ongoing philosophical debate of whether products or services which utilize open source are subject to the same intellectual property laws and behaviors as non-open source software offerings," Ryan said in a statement. "We do not philosophically differentiate any company, but rather seek to consistently and fairly monetize patent rights from those companies which incorporate patented technologies." The company also dismissed allegations that Microsoft somehow is using it as a kind of proxy to fight a patent battle against Linux. A pair of key employees recently joined the patent-holding firm from Microsoft. End quote. Now, additionally, Grok Law notes that the patent involved here is scheduled to expire on December 10th, 2008, so just over a year from now this is going to expire. That could explain why Microsoft, who could easily afford to ensure that the case lasts longer than that, has not been made a target. Kind of strangely reassuring to see that this may not have anything to do with open source, and that's really a sad indication of the state of the current system. But I wouldn't rule anything out entirely. I'm sure some more details are going to come out about this, and it's clearly something that everyone's going to be watching closely. The next story I have is Apple. We plan to have an iPhone SDK in developers' hands by February. So Apple has finally announced a real and official SDK for the iPhone, and this is from the Apple announcement. Quote, "Third-party applications on the iPhone. Let me just say it. We want native third-party applications on the iPhone, and we plan to have an SDK in developers' hands in February. We are excited about creating a vibrant third-party developer community around the iPhone and enabling hundreds of new applications for our users. With our revolutionary multi-touch interface, powerful hardware, and advanced software architecture, we believe we have created the best mobile platform ever for developers. It will take until February to release an SDK because we are trying to do two diametrically opposed things at once. Provide an advanced and open platform to developers, while at the same time protect iPhone users from viruses, malware, privacy attacks, etc. This is no easy task. Some claim that virus and malware are not a problem on mobile phones. This is simply not true. There have been serious viruses on other mobile phones already, including some that silently spread from phone to phone over the cell network. As our phones become more powerful, these malicious programs will become more dangerous, and since the iPhone is the most advanced phone ever, it will be a highly visible target. Some companies are already taking action. Nokia, for example, is not allowing any application to be loaded on some of their newest phones unless they have a digital signature that can be traced back to a known developer. While this makes such a phone less than totally open, we believe it's a step in the right direction. We are working on an advanced system which will offer developers broad access to natively program the iPhone, amazing software platform, while at the same time protecting users from malicious programs." End quote. Now obviously here there's a lot of speculation about whether or not the dedicated iPhone hackers forced Apple's hand on this one. If you look at the Springboard breakdown, which is kind of the iPhone equivalent of the Finder, some amount of support for additional apps have been there since the beginning, and the latest 1.1.1 release seems to have increased that. So the question here in my mind becomes, with the PR beating that it was taking, why didn't Apple announce this when the iPhone was initially released? And then after that, what took them so long to just at least announce it? And only Jobs knows for sure, I guess, but announcing it from the very beginning would likely have caused some people to hold off on their purchase, and obviously that's not something Apple would want, or any of Apple's partners, including AT&T. As for what's taking so long, it could really be a variety of things. The latest firmware release clearly shows, I think, that the iPhone's platform is still a rapidly moving and rapidly changing target, so Apple may just have wanted things to stabilize a bit before letting others in. Although there could be a variety of other reasons, and a couple come to mind, so you can kind of search around on the blogosphere if you're more interested in that aspect. To me, it will be interesting to see how Apple rolls this out. And one of the main questions is, will apps have to be digitally signed by Apple, and will there be a fee associated with that? And will the only installation mechanism be iTunes? And we'll have to wait and see. February's just a couple of months away. And while I'm really glad to see this announcement, although I don't think they really had much of a choice in the end if they wanted this to be a truly successful platform long term, it's probably not enough for me to not switch to the OpenMoko device in December when that comes out. It's just too compelling of a device, I think, from my perspective, for me not to change, although I may keep the iPhone also. The next story I have is the OSI approves Microsoft license submissions. A few months ago, as I reported on this podcast, Microsoft submitted the Microsoft Permissive License and the Microsoft Community License to the OSI for approval. Now, both have been approved, albeit with some modifications, including name changes for both. And this is from the official announcement from the OSI. Quote, acting on the advice of the License Approval Chair, the OSI Board today approved the Microsoft Public License and the Microsoft Reciprocal License. The decision to approve was informed by the overwhelming, though not unanimous, consensus from the open source community that these licenses satisfied the 10 criteria of the open source definition and should therefore be approved. The formal evaluation of these licenses began in August, and the discussion of these licenses was vigorous and thorough. The community raised questions that Microsoft and others answered. They raised issues that, when germane to the license in question, Microsoft addressed. Microsoft came to the OSI and submitted their licenses according to the published policies and procedures that dozens of other parties have followed over the years. Microsoft didn't ask for special treatment and didn't receive any. In spite of recent negative interactions between Microsoft and the open source community, the spirit of the dialogue was constructive, and we hope that carries forward to a constructive outcome as well. End quote. And it's clear that some in the community, although I think a vast minority, wanted these licenses to be rejected really just solely on the fact that it was Microsoft that submitted them. And while it's easy to be mistrusting of Microsoft, and for good reason in many cases, that would have been being petty just for the sake of being petty, and just not at all in the spirit of the open source community. If you truly believe in choice, and these licenses meet the OSD, which the OSI thinks they do, so that's good enough for me, then it's reasonable that they should be legitimate options regardless of who came up with them. Russ Nelson, who's on the OSI board, had more to say, and this is from his blog post. Quote, of course, Microsoft is not widely trusted in the open source world, and their motives have been called into question during the approval discussions. How can they be attacking open source projects on one hand and seeking not only to use open source methods, but use of the OSI-approved open source trademark? Nobody knows for sure except Microsoft. But if you are confident that open source is the best way to develop software, as we are at the Open Source Initiative, then you can see why Microsoft would both attack open source and seek to use it at the same time. It is both their salvation and their enemy. End quote. And it should obviously be pretty interesting to see where Microsoft goes from here. This isn't, of course, a carte blanche for them to start claiming open source or that they are open source. After all, as only code licensed under one of these two licenses qualifies as open source. But what they do with this, and really how they shepherd this into what they do in the future, is going to say a lot about Microsoft's final goals towards open source. The last story I have is Oracle mulls vote on open source at upcoming shareholder meeting. I've been chatting with Jonas recently about an issue that Matt just pointed out, and this is from a post on Matt's blog. Quote, on Friday, November 2nd, Oracle will convene in its shareholder meeting. As part of that meeting this year, it's supposed to consider an open source friendly proposal, which, for a variety of reasons, it is asking its shareholders to reject. And you can see page 55 of the Oracle proxy statement for more information. What is the proposal? That Oracle adopt a resolution that the company consider the social and environmental impact of using open source. The underlying intention, I believe, is to nudge Oracle to take a more protective approach to open source. Oracle wants the resolution axed. The language of the shareholder proposal is fairly vague, which may be one reason it's not getting much love from Oracle. However, as Jonas Krohn, the attorney representing Lawrence Fahn, Oracle shareholder, told me, SEC rules significantly restrict what they can ask for in the proposal, forcing them to file a proposal that focused on social and environmental impacts, a very safe area within the SEC rules. So, the proposal actually calls for this resolution. The shareholders request that the board issue, at reasonable expense, an open-source social responsibility report to shareholders by April 2008 that discusses the social and environmental impacts of Oracle's existing and potential open-source policies and practices. We request the report be a policy-level discussion which excludes proprietary and confidential information, including, for example, information that may interfere with litigation, legal strategies, lobbying, or regulatory issues. To my unstudied eye, this seems to not go far enough, but Krohn indicated that the proposal is not meant to be a be-all, end-all for Oracle on open source. Rather, it's intended to serve as a placeholder and an opportunity for Fahn to get the issue of open source on the Oracle's board agenda rather than as a complete reflection of Fahn and Krohn's goals or interests. However, he noted that even despite this limitation to shareholder proposals, the structure still enables him to use this mechanism to solicit real change in corporate behavior through dialogue. What could be accomplished with this proposal? It's a way for Oracle shareholders to demonstrate support for Oracle's open source efforts and vote to encourage them to go further. End quote. As pointed out to me by Jonas, it's not that Oracle is doing anything predatory or wrong with regard to open source now. It's that his client thinks that they can and should do more moving forward. Now, unlike Matt and, of course, Jonas, I am not a lawyer. And Jonas took the time to explain a lot of the procedures to me. And as indicated by Matt, the request is more of a placeholder than really a complete request. But if you're interested in this, you should go to page 55 of the Oracle proxy statement and get the complete details. I'm personally not an Oracle shareholder and actually never have been. But if you are, this is your chance to be heard. So if you have any questions, let me know and I'll be happy to pass any of them on to Jonas. But from what I'm told, a small number of votes here actually can make a very real difference. And here's why, and this is directly from Jonas. Quote, given the fact that Larry Ellison owns just shy of 25% of Oracle shares and mutual funds and other institutional investors who invariably will vote with management as a matter of practice on this own around 40%, a vote in favor of just 5% would actually be very meaningful because it means that 15% of shareholders who, as a practical matter, would actually think about how to vote, voted for the proposal. Put another way, if a single shareholder owning 15% or even 5% of the company asked management to pay attention to an issue, they likely would. In fact, under securities laws, 5% ownership is considered significant enough to warrant specific disclosures of information. The point being that the shareholder resolution presents a leverage point that can be used to communicate to management in a powerful way that its investors think Oracle should continue to take positive steps towards open source. End quote. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.